Thanks for listening to the Henry Center podcast. We seek to bridge the gap between the academy and the church by cultivating resources and communities that advance Christian wisdom. If you'd like to learn more about the Henry Center, please visit our website at henrycenter.org. There, you can find hundreds of articles, videos, and publications which promote theological understanding. The best way to stay connected with us is to subscribe to our newsletter, though you can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. If you're able, we'd love to see you at one of our upcoming events, hosted at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Our public lectures feature scholars and pastors offering careful reflection on a range of biblical, theological, and ecclesial topics. We hope you enjoy today's discussion.
Well, I couldn't be more delighted to have been invited back here. Thank you, Josh and Matt, and anybody who had a part of that invitation. This is really a pleasure. Thank you. So, a lot of theological hay has been made of the fact that Jesus' first miracle was changing water into wine at a wedding. Certainly, it's symbolic of God's blessing of the sacrament of marriage, and it's a foreshadowing of the marriage feast of the Lamb, the party of all parties. But I'm going to make even more hay of this by starting my reflections here, because Jesus didn't just make wine, he made excellent wine, astonishing the guests with its quality. And he did it at the end of the celebration, which could only have extended the event. At least I would have stayed longer if there was excellent wine, earning him the reputation of a wine bibber and a glutton. So why did Jesus take that risk? I think it's in part because it underscores the reality that the gospel isn't just good news that we learn about with our minds. It's an invitation to an experience of God that we must have with our bodies and our souls. And the invitation is always the same, to taste and see that the Lord is good. They feast on the abundance of your house, writes the psalmist. You give them drink from your river of delights. And on this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. And on that day, he will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. And of course, the promise and the invitation is to taste the best food and wine of all, the Eucharist. This is my body, given for you. Jesus' incarnation means, among many other things, that creation itself is good, and that the ultimate reality of the universe is a feast given by the bridegroom for his bride. The ultimate reality is personal, it is communion, it is love. So what does that have to do with poetry, you might be wondering. I'm so glad you asked. I have long believed and taught hundreds of students through the years that all of the arts are an invitation to experience the world as gift. For to taste and see that creation itself is a river of delights is to necessarily move one step closer to the giver of that gift. This is so because art is an experience of the beauty of creation, not an argument about it. All artists know this by instinct, whether they acknowledge it or not. That's an important piece of it. They may not even know, but that's what they're doing. And poets, I will argue this morning, are the ones at the top of the mountain shouting or whispering provocatively, taste and see that the Lord is good, to a world that is increasingly too busy to stop and wonder. Poets are also the ones bringing out the finest wines, extending the feast, inviting us to remember why we're really here and what matters, which is being together in community and inviting others in to taste and see that the Lord is good. I've devoted my career to the power of the literary arts because what they do has no substitute and no parallel. No substitute and no parallel. And also because it just might be that the church's biggest problem right now is that we have forgotten how to invite people to taste and see. right? And to see how marvelous this love feast really is. So I'm making the case for poetry as theological invitation. My desire is twofold, that we return to the poetry in the scripture with greater aesthetic attention, but it's also my desire that all congregations grow in the arts that provide this kind of experience, including giving the sharing and reading of poetry a chance to transform the way we see the world, and especially the way we see each other. So I'm going to keep my argument simple so as to save time to walk with you through a few of my favorite poems, because art is experience, and it's one that's even more enjoyable when shared. So I'm going to first talk about how poetry invites us to experience the goodness and beauty of creation and of Jesus as the ultimate form, right, of that creation, and then how poetry invites us to the possibility for transformation that comes from tasting and seeing the goodness of the Lord. So those are the two parts. So first, poetry as an invitation to taste and see the goodness and beauty of all creation. As you all know, the liturgical invitation to the table, taste and see that the Lord is good, that you'll hear the minister sometimes say, comes from Psalm 34. So let's briefly consider this psalm as the poem that it is. I wish I were a Hebrew scholar so that you can better see my argument, but Michelle Knight's got your back. Which is that the beauty of the poem as a work of art is essential to the experience that it offers the reader. Right, so you have to get it as poetry to get all of it. An experience that goes, as I've said, beyond argument. But we'll just have to suffer through my lack of knowledge of Hebrew. Okay, so here are the first 8 verses in the Revised Standard Translation. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Look to him and be radiant, so your faces shall never be ashamed. This poor soul cried and was heard by the Lord and was saved from every trouble. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Happy are those who take refuge in him. Now, to remind you, the context of the psalm is important. It's that David is praising the Lord for his deliverance from Abimelech. Okay? The reason that's important is because the psalmist is an artist. He is a poet who is inviting us to experience with him. He's inviting us to experience with him the joy of God's goodness and his deliverance. He is not simply relating the event. He has made a celebratory song out of it. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. In other words, David has had an experience of reality that requires a response, and that happens to be the starting point for poetry. The theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar, who I love, calls this need for a response to the goodness and beauty of the Lord the demand of the beautiful. And although the quote that I will share from him is a bit of a mouthful, right, Kevin? Von Balthasar can have a little bit of a mouthful. I cannot overemphasize its importance for a theology of the arts. Balthasar is saying that because of the incarnation, truth, goodness, and beauty have been revealed to have form. Truth, goodness, and beauty exist in the world and not just in Plato's mind. Okay? Form, argues von Balthasar, requires a corresponding form that matches it. The only fitting response is, for David, a song that can be sung, memorized, and shared. All right, so here's the quote from von Balthasar, and it's long, but bear with me. Through his body, man is in the world. As he expresses himself, he acts and intervenes responsibly in the general situation. He inscribes his deeds indelibly upon the book of history, which, whether he likes it or not, henceforth bears his imprint permanently. Here, at the very latest, man must realize that he is not lord over himself. neither does he rule his own being in freedom so as to confirm form upon himself, nor is he free in his communication. As body, man is a being whose condition it is always to be communicated. Indeed, he regains himself only on account of having been communicated. For this reason, man is whole as a whole. Oops, wrong one. Man as a whole is not an archetype of being and of spirit, rather their image. He is not the primal word, but a response. He is not a speaker, but an expression governed by the laws of beauty, laws which man cannot impose on himself. As a totality of spirit and body, man must make himself into God's mirror and seek to attain to that transcendence and radiance that must be found in the world's substance if it is indeed God's image and likeness, his word and gesture, action and drama. Now, there's a ton of content here. I realize that, and I'm not going to go into all of it. Don't worry. But notice that Balthasar insists that the reality of being a created being, of having a body, means that all of our language is a response to the original being, the Word made flesh, Jesus Christ, who created all things, was before all things, and in whom all things hold together. We cannot confirm form and meaning on ourselves. Rather, we discover the beautiful gift of our lives here as beings made in the image of God, and then of the love of God for us in spite of our sinfulness, right? Since his goodness and love are beautiful, the appropriate response must also be beautiful. It is not enough for David to simply text God and say, thanks, God, praying hands, smiley emojis. It's not enough, okay? Since I'm at risk of losing your attention by quoting this dense philosophical comment followed by this non sequitur, let me regain it again by saying that this is a lot less complicated than it appears to be. Consider what happened on October 12th, 2021. On that evening, that very evening, my cousin's son, a little fellow by the name of Jackson Cerny, at that time 4 years old, was watching a sunset with his parents in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. This is not the exact photo, but it was something like this. At one point, he jumped up energetically, pointed his finger at the sunset, and declared, God is painting the sky. And of course, my cousin immediately sent all this comment around to everybody on WhatsApp and whatever. Now, why was my cousin compelled to share this? Because Jackson's response was commensurate with the event. Through his response, he became a poet, the author of an undeniably poetic utterance. Pointing with his finger and speaking with his mouth, he became a seer and a sayer of the beauty of the body of the world. To say God is painting the sky is to render an astonishing experience of beauty with a fresh metaphor that helps us to see it for what it really is. That's poetry. So let me draw on one of my favorite poets of all time, Denis Levertov, to describe how the poet's attention to the beauty of creation demands a beautiful response and also invites the reader into that experience with her. First, a poet, she explains, through attentiveness, has a powerful experience, a sequence of perceptions that are, quote, felt by the poet intensely enough to demand of him their equivalents in words. He is brought to speech. So when Jackson saw the sunset, the experience led to words of praise. It woke in him a demand, a need to respond to something that adequately corresponds with his experience. And that's the primary condition, she says, of being a poet. But the fulfillment of that demand, continues Levertov, take a sip, is to contemplate, to meditate, words which connote a state in which the heat of feeling warms the intellect. To contemplate comes from templum, temple, a place, a space for observation marked out by the augur. It means not simply to observe, to regard, but to do these things in the presence of a God. And to meditate is to keep the mind in a state of contemplation. Its synonym is to muse. And to muse comes from a word meaning stand with open mouth. not so comical if we think of inspiration to breathe in. So, as the poet stands open-mouthed in the temple of life, contemplating his experience, there come to him the first words of the poem. The words which are to be his way into the poem, if there is to be a poem. I can't recommend her new and selected essays on poetry enough if you are interested in this. Now, the act of attending with the senses and emotions, one's body, comes first, followed seamlessly by contemplation. The word contemplation is theologically charged. It requires the recognition of divine presence. Something special is going on here that did not originate in me, is really what it's being said. Something that demands and deserves my attention and my response. So the easiest way to say what I'm getting at here is that we need to read poetry to experience all the arts because we have lost the ability to see the sunset as the gift for that it really is. That's why we need all of the arts, because we have lost this ability, or we're always in danger of losing it. So let me share with you a famous poem that insists on poetry as the best way to recover sense of wonder. It's likely to be familiar to you, but because it's a great work of art, it keeps giving new insights and discoveries to the readers, and not just because the poet happens to be a believer. This happens with great secular poetry too. And this is because of what von Balthasar is talking about. The good, the beautiful, and the true are inherently bound together. So if you have one, you have some of the others. Where you have goodness and truth, you also have beauty, and it can't be otherwise. So here's the poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins called God's Grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel, being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. Two glorious stanzas at which I will only be able to scratch the surface. This poem was written during the Industrial Age in Victorian England, and Hopkins was rightly worried about the world being bleared and smeared with toil and man's smell. If you think about it, it had to be pretty bad. He was worried that the flaming out of God's glorious creation would be crushed by humanity's lack of care for it. That this poem is more relevant now than ever before is part of the reason why I've chosen it. The poem is about what scholars call the Anthropocene, the age that marks that show that the marks of humanity's trotting are all over creation, never to be fully erased. In the 21st century, as you know, efforts by many climate change experts have become desperate to try to stop the destruction. But Hopkins has a slightly different view. He's asking us to stop and take another look at what's going on. Yes, generations have trod upon the earth, but still there lives the dearest freshness deep down things. Notice that this dearest freshness can only be found deep down things under the surface destruction, because creation is being renewed daily and it will be ultimately renewed during the new creation. The speaker insists that the world is so charged with the grandeur of God that no activity of humankind can ultimately destroy it. We can certainly do our best, right, and we will destroy things, but not ultimately, because it will be restored. Now, that's just the argument of the poem, and that's pretty easy to discern. But this is art, not argument. And Hopkins invites the reader into an experience of that freshness deep down things. So if we were in class together, we would see how all this works, but we're not, so I'll just give you a few hints. The rhythm, along with the rhyme scheme, is what gives the poem, first, its downward worry, right? Half-trod, half-trod, half-trod. It's not half-trod, trod, trod. It's half-trod, half-trod, half-trod. And then its upward creative energy, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. Hopkins invented something called sprung rhythm, and I won't go into specifics, but it's basically taking the expected rhythm of iambic pentameter, which is the most common rhythm in English poetry, and detonates it, causing surprise and delight for the reader. Here's a typical couplet written in perfect iambic pentameter. Know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. This is Alexander Pope, and so 18th century. Notice the order, the regularity, as if the world can be fully categorized and accurately described like a scientific textbook. Now you see the iambic stresses and that there are five, hence iambic pentameter. Dun, 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 okay? But notice how Hopkins twists it. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. Notice how flame out and shook foil disrupt the regularity of the iambs that are expected in iambic pentameter. Again, I'm not going to give you the specific vocabulary for this, because what I want you to focus on is its effects, how you feel the rhythms of this poem in your body. You don't just see it on the page, right? And that's why poetry is better read aloud, it's because you feel it. You know, it will flame out like shining from shook foil, and it disrupts it. Art is experience, not argument. When I was here at the Henry Center for that glorious year of study and fellowship with other scholars, I did a lot of research into the field of neurocognitive poetics. I wanted to see what your brain looks like on poetry. And as I'll get to later in this talk, the brilliance of the word resonance to describe our experience of all the arts, and especially music, is that the experience is an embodied one. You feel it in your gut, your bones, deep down in your soul. Those embodied experiences are all generated, of course, initially by something going on in your brain. Now, what I discovered did not surprise me, but did delight me to no end, okay? And that is that the way that poetry forces you to slow down, even over a single word that the poet has defamiliarized for you, just a single word even, actually has a calming effect. When a person experiences anxiety, whether stimulated by something real or illusory, which we do every day, right? It's part of the modern experience. The amygdala, that little part in there that looks like a snake or something, it's like the lizard brain. The amygdala is overactivated, and that's your fear response. And what that does is it disrupts the efficiency of the functional link between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex, which is your executive center. It compromises the connection between the two. So recent research in neuroscience indicates that it's this functional connectivity between the two that is required to be able to regulate one's emotions to reduce anxiety, right? So when that is overstimulated, you can't learn either. You know, so it's a really interesting connection there. So don't leave me yet, but because here's the kicker, especially when we are considering God's grandeur, for instance, as theological invitation. According to recent research, when the meditation includes gratitude, the response is even more pronounced across the nervous system. So if the poet even gives you, through one word, an experience of gratitude for the beauty of that word for something, it calms you down even further. Poetry is an invitation to taste and see that the Lord is good. To taste that goodness, to really taste it, is to be filled with gratitude. And it's to want to join in with others, to respond, to celebrate, to feast. And thus are the arts born, and thus are they renewed. And that leads me to my second point, which is to say that poetry is an invitation to the possibility of transformation that can only come through this experience. It can't come any other way. To begin this section of my talk, I'll share another of my favorite poems of all time, I Dwell in Possibility, by Emily Dickinson. the great poet Emily Dickinson. I'm just taking a little moment to just say, isn't this great? Thank you all for being here. I know that not poetry is not everybody's thing, but just bear with me. I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior for doors, of chambers as the cedars, impregnable of eye, and for an everlasting roof, the gambrels of the sky, of visitors the fairest, for occupation this, the spreading wide my narrow hands to gather paradise. Now, this is a little more complex, so I'm going to read it again. Experience it. I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior for doors, of chambers as the cedars, the trees, right? Chambers of the cedars, impregnable of eye, and for an everlasting roof, the gambrels of the sky, of visitors the fairest, for occupation this, the spreading wide my narrow hands to gather paradise. There is so much to say about this poem and how marvelous it is, but of course I have to restrict myself. Its beauty comes from imagining language as a dwelling place. Language is a dwelling, because it is a dwelling place. We live inside of language. All of our experiences are mediated by language. Not all of them, but a lot of them. From the stories we tell ourselves about the meaning of our lives to the response we have in the traffic jam we're stuck in, none of these are really possible, fully possible, without language. So Dickinson insists that to dwell in poetry is to dwell in possibility. It is to dwell in hope and joy. In the immortal words of that other poet, Farrell Williams, it compels you to clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. I'm happy. It's more like I'm joyful. My husband's like, what does that mean? It means, it's Emily Dickinson, explain what that means. There's no sky, there's no limit. I feel like a room without a roof. To say that to dwell in poetry, to dwell in poetry is a fairer house than prose, is to say that we settle for a prosaic life when a poetic one is always possible. We choose the prosaic life over the poetic one. And what is a poetic life? For this, we can turn to this final stanza where Dickinson lets us chew on some interesting ideas, right? So first, of visitors, the fairest. Which means, I think, that when you dwell in the house of poetry, you just get to sit tight and the poetry comes to you. As many different visitors as you want, with only the most important realities in their mouths. Everyone knows that Dickinson was quite reclusive during her most productive years, but don't think that means that she was lonely or joyless. Far from it. She invited people she wanted to converse with, but since there were very few people alive who were as alive to the poetic life as she was, she decided much more often to select her own society. That purpose is in this last stanza too, the double meaning of the word occupation. To occupy the house of poetry completely is to have the occupation of being a poet. That was certainly Emily Dickinson's call, and I honestly can't imagine how impoverished the American imagination would be without her. But we too can occupy the house of poetry, if only for a short period of time, as we experience with the poet what she is doing, which is spreading wide her narrow hands to gather paradise. So beautiful. Our problem is not that the world is empty of God's grandeur and glory. It is that we don't sit in the house of poetry long enough to gather it in, to taste that grandeur along with the poet. Now, why don't we do that? Because it's difficult, especially for us late moderns, to slow down, to stop doing, and start receiving grace. Consider these words from, of all people, the pragmatist philosopher John Dewey, whose book, Art as Experience, is undervalued. This is a really interesting quote. The aesthetic or undergoing phase of experience is receptive. It involves surrender. But adequate yielding of the self is possible only through a controlled activity that may well be intense. And that activity, I would argue, is attention, right? Deep and focused attention, very intense. In much of our intercourse with our surroundings, we withdraw, sometimes from fear, if only of expending unduly our store of energy. Perception is an act of the going out of energy in order to receive, not a withholding of energy. To steep ourselves in a subject matter, we have first to plunge into it. When we are only passive to a scene, it overwhelms us, and for lack of answering activity, we do not perceive that which bears us down. We must summon energy and pitch it at a responsive key in order to take it in. Like, you have to be able to respond. You have to pay attention and be able to respond in order to actually have the experiences. There's a lot there, but it's very, very interesting. These words explain why engaging with art, especially the art of poetry, is as essential as it is difficult. It requires a totally different kind of energy to slow down and look along with the poet at something that we have missed. The thing is that something that we have missed is the part of reality that actually has the capacity to enlarge our souls, right? But we've got to respond. We've got to put ourselves in the position for that. It is much, much easier, as he alludes to here, to keep our souls small and fearful and comfortable. A lot easier. It takes a lot less energy. Bishop Robert Barron is excellent on this point. Love his books. He describes that the spiritual journey is one of moving from having a small and fearful soul, the pusilla anima, from which we get the word pusillanimous, to the large and generous soul, the magna anima, from which we get one of my favorite words of all time, magnanimous. To receive that which expands us in that way requires willingness to change and the kind of receptive energy that Dewey describes here. Another way to put this, maybe simpler, is that the poets are trying to transform us from Marthas into Marys, right? Which is much harder than it seems like it should be. The reason we late moderns need to be attentive and receptive to the invitation of poetry now more than ever is because we live in an increasingly accelerating world, a society of Marthas on acid, right? The sociologist Hartmut Rosa has described this change very lucidly in books like The Uncontrollability of the World and Resonance. I'm really into Hartmut Rosa right now. He's kind of shocked by how many Christians and artists are responding to his work. I'm like, you shouldn't be surprised. I just got a chance to meet him when I was at Cambridge, and I was like, you should not be surprised by that at all, and you'll see why. My hypothesis is this. Because we as late modern human beings aim to make the world controllable at every level, individual, cultural, institutional, and structural, we invariably encounter the world as a point of aggression or as a series of points of aggression. In other words, as a series of objects that we have to know, attain, conquer, master, or exploit. And precisely because of this, life, the experience of feeling alive and of truly encountering the world, that which makes resonance possible, always seems to elude us. This in turn leads to anxiety, frustration, anger, and even despair, which then manifest themselves, among other things, in acts of impotent political aggression. Whoa. To be a modern person is to breathe the air of the illusion that the world is controllable. We are enculturated, especially in the United States, to go after a bigger piece of the pie, greater success, more productivity, your platform. A world of miserable Marthas, for whom busyness and exhaustion has become its own status symbol. What Rosa is so brilliant at describing is how being unable to slow down and inhabit time and reality differently is what prevents us from experiences of resonance. Those moments when we feel, like along with Julian of Norwich, for instance, that all's well with the world. We can just be in this moment. All things shall be well. Right now, without needing to control it. Okay? So here's how Rosa describes the transforming power of experiences of resonance. Whenever we resonate with another human being, it's not just through the arts. The arts is one of the peak places of resonance, but we can experience resonance at all times. You have to be open to it, right? So whenever we resonate with another human being, a book, a song, a landscape, an idea, a piece of wood, we are transformed by the encounter, although, of course, in very different ways. There are encounters that leave us a different person in their wake. And there are adaptive transformations that produce barely noticeable, if only temporary, changes, for example, in our voice. In every instance, however, a change in how we relate to the world is constitutive of resonant experience. When we resonate with the world, we are no longer the same afterwards. Experiencing resonance transforms us, and it is precisely this transformation that makes us feel alive. If we no longer allow ourselves to be called or transformed, if we find ourselves no longer able to effectively respond to the multitude of voices all around us, then we feel dead inside, petrified, in short, incapable of resonance. It is easy, I think, from these quotes to see why we need the arts more than ever before. It is because they teach us how to inhabit time differently. They teach us that a patient, receptive attitude is more important than an impatient, product-oriented one. They teach us that we must be first before we endeavor to do, or that all of our doing will be so much dry straw. Now, you shouldn't need me to say that just reading poetry is not going to solve this problem. You can read poetry all day long and still not experience transformative resonance. Just ask anybody with a PhD in English, okay? Instead, we must do what we can, I think, to challenge our brothers and sisters first to inhabit time differently. To my mind, this begins with keeping the Sabbath, because it is then that we stop trying to wrestle profit from the earth, as Abraham Heschel puts it, in order to, quote, care for the seed of eternity planted in the soul. From there, we should build what I call a Sabbath mindset, where we create and protect nests of time, and then learn how to guard those nests of time from the cowbirds of distraction, who are always trying to lay their hideous progeny in those nests. That's hard work. Today, especially. How to do that subject of another talk, and I love to talk about that, so if you ever want to hear me on that, I'd love to talk. For now, I want you to give you a taste of it. And I'll do that with the final favorite poem of mine, one that will also make you long for summer, since we are here in the voids of late January in Chicago. This is called, I love this so much, Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. The poet is James Wright. So I'm going to read it twice. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkness darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over looking for home. I have wasted my life. A moment. Remember, poetry is experience. So try to experience this. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life. And again, if we were in class together, Or if we were in the poetry reading group that you're going to immediately form in your churches after listening to me today, we would discuss this as slowly and carefully it deserves, and you would eventually be dazzled by its immense beauty, even though it seems simple. But since we are not, I'll just walk you a little bit through it. The speaker is in a hammock in a very specific place, William Duffy's farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. The specificity is important. It is a nod to the fact that each of us have only one life, and that any given moment we can only be in one location, in spite of what the transhumanists would like to, you know, dream about. Additionally, we have only the present moment, and that is all we will ever have, okay? By virtue of being in this hammock on a fine summer day, and of being receptive, one gets the feeling at long last, to being in this moment alone, the speaker experiences resonance. Resonance. He notices things the way only a receptive soul can, and time slows way down. He is in the hammock from afternoon until evening, and his observations become aesthetic. They become the necessarily beautiful response, as I mentioned before, to the beauty of the created world. The beauty of the world is so rich that requires the creativity of metaphor to reveal. Just like Jackson, that was a metaphor, right? God is painting the sky. A bronze butterfly, which is a piece of art, right, incapable of actual life or movement, is asleep on the black trunk and blowing like a leaf. Cowbells follow one another in the distance, and most magnificently of all, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. Notice that this metaphor does not create the beauty of all things, year-old horse dung. It rather discovers it, reveals it, and allows us to experience the moment of that discovery. The world blazes up with the beauty it already had. Needless to say, this discovery takes time, stillness, space, which is why, as evening settles over the scene, the speaker concludes, "I have wasted my life." The speaker has not wasted his life because he didn't write that other book of poems or, you know, go to X many concerts or whatever else. The speaker has wasted his life because he didn't sit in a hammock for more of it. The speaker learns that the call to the poetic life is a call to receive the real in the only moment that is available to us right now. And the real is astonishingly beautiful. Beauty that points us one way, home. Thanks for listening, for being here today.